Let's talk about. Today's episode is going to be a rather emotional one. The idea came to us just a couple of weeks ago. It was just a normal Tuesday evening. I was wrapping up my work for the day before heading home. And I glanced at the calendar and it just hit me. It hit me how long my manuscript has been on hold. And on top of that, the deadline for submission was slowly approaching and there was little more I could do. This also meant that I would have to make ever urgent corrections right before the deadline, sacrificing my sleep and, well, sanity. Yes, this is how it often goes in science, and yes, it's not the end of the world, but it is when many of such problems, big and small, accumulate over a period of time that the bubble of your patience just bursts. And what I did next was exactly what anyone would do. I texted my friend, in this case Ileana, and we decided to make a whole episode about the frequent problems we encounter in academia. And many of them are often talked about, some maybe less so, but we really wanted to let our steam out.
Right. It has so often been the case for me as well, Anastasia, that I might find myself depending on others or in general encountering an obstacle and forcing myself to get over it, forget about it, move on, as you said. And there is that shame culture nurtured in academia that makes you be silent or end up ranting about these things to the wrong people. So when you messaged me about the episode, my reaction was like, yes, let's do that.
Well, that's great. That's great. We're definitely on the same page. And
yes, absolutely.
Yeah, buckle up. And yeah, it's going to be a very entertaining rage episode today. Yeah, but before we indulge in listing all the shortcomings of academia, I think it's important to consider where most of the problems stem from. And what is unique to academia and to other professions like artists and writers, for example, is that it's an interest-based job, but it's job nonetheless.
You phrased it so nicely. And it's something that people always get confused about, because if you start complaining, then they will automatically tell you, if you're not happy, then why don't you find another job? Leave academia. And then you say, but I like my research area. It is my passion. And people to that, they often reply, then stop whining about these things and focus on your research. Of course, it is worth saying that all jobs come with things that render employees unhappy. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, you shouldn't feel suppressed to express how you feel.
Yes, and some problems are very unique to academia, and some indeed, as you just mentioned, they are basically universal to all the other fields. I guess we will discuss the second part later in a separate episode, and today we will focus more on what is really special in academia. Well, I mean, you can still argue whether or not there's still...
I mean, still... we might end up, you know, rumbling about things and talking about problems we face or ranting about problems we face in academia that someone from outside academia feels it's relatable to them too. So it's good. But we will have for sure a second episode dedicated to problems that can be found common in the job market.
There are just too many of them, but not spoiling too much.
No.
Yeah, but I would go first with just mentioning, addressing the elephant in the room, which is salary, which is often also a taboo to talk about, as you again mentioned just now, because it's a passion job, many people feel like, oh, but that's what I do for my interest, out of my pure interest. Well, your interest will not really feed you. It's not gonna bring food to your table. Scientists are the same humans as other people. They also want to wear good clothes. They also want to eat good food and travel, and that needs to be covered by your salary.
Yes, exactly. And like, let's not forget the very basic thing besides food is to pay your rent. So if you live especially in a big city, like we do, we live in Helsinki, and rents are high, but our offices are at the city center, it will be nice to have the ability to live near our office and not have to commute for 1 hour to get to work, just because we will get a more affordable rent, or a rent that's within our salaries. And then many of us are young people. Some are doctoral researchers like you, Anastasia, or early career stage researchers after their PhD like me. And we have to live life. I mean, we are young today, also in age, and there's so many things we can see and do and have a healthy, what they call life-work balance. But if our salary doesn't help us achieve that, then what can we do? We can complain about it and hope that at some point someone will listen, right?
And often we have to work overtime, but because this is a good and a bad thing. Our hours aren't always recorded. I don't know about other countries, but here in Finland, they don't ask researchers to put their working hours very strictly. So you may end up having maybe a shorter day, or more often times a longer day. But because it's not recorded, it's not ever compensated to you. And of course, in other places, you may get some sort of bonus, or your boss will notice that and maybe give you a promotion, but none of this really exists in academia. And if anything, you're expected to work hard as just part of your job description, apparently, but more of an unwritten rules.
Yes, I think a job in academia is quite often treated like you are a student. And you have the courses in the morning, but you still have to do your homework in the afternoon and evening. Or if you have exams, you might have to stay extra hours and sleep less just to study for the exam. And this kind of habit is carried on to the next academic level and the next academic level. And then there's also a lot of competition. So you start adding more and more and more to your agenda. And before you know it, from working too many hours because you love what you're doing and you just got carried away and started working until the deep night, or you work too many hours because you just have so many things that you can't do in this 8 hour interval. And as you accurately said, we do not register our hours. And even though we are working often extra hours, we are not paid for that. And in the end, what you will become is a very exhausted person who will lose their motivation.
Burnout is very common.
Exactly. Burnout is so common in academia. And I know in some places, like in the University of Helsinki, they are trying to take measures to help mitigate for that. But some of the measures is putting a lot of pressure on the individual. And I call them measures, of course, they're not measures, but they're recommendations. Like they say, you need to take care of your life-work balance. As if it is only our responsibility to ensure that we are having a life-work balance. What about the competition, the lack of jobs that make me want to work more to be more competent than someone else? Because we are all very good scientists in the end. And you just have to gain all these little extra skills that you gain on your free hours, like your personal time, in order to become competent and, you know, for the one or two permanent positions that might open somewhere. And another thing that they often do is that here, come and listen to this workshop on how to manage your time, how to manage your project. And again, it's put as, you know, if you are able to manage your time and do very good dissemination of your tasks, then you won't have to work extra hours, right?
Yeah, we told you, like, you could do it. It's up to you whether or not you actually did.
Exactly. It's like, again, putting that pressure on the individual. So your advice to do it, it's good for your health. But yeah, we can't kind of change the system. We need a system shift for mitigating this issue.
So a couple of comments to what you just said. Well, yes, competition is extremely high in academia. And again, you can argue this could be a good thing because, of course, you want the scientists to be the best they can possibly become. But at the same time, it adds this additional stress, and it gives the opportunity to universities to not increase the salary. So when you have more than 10 people, for example, going for this low paid position, there will be at least one person so desperate that they will accept whatever amount of money you give them. But this doesn't necessarily apply in other places. For example, industry, the very common competitor of academia, where a majority of people have actually been fleeing, especially at this time during the times of crisis. And there they are able to offer better pay. But I've been reading also like different blogs before this, and people raise very good concerns because, again, given a higher pay doesn't necessarily mean that you will be getting a better qualified person. But I just still believe that it's nicer when you can reward someone for very hard work they're doing. Yeah, so it's a very difficult balance. It needs maybe more systematic changes overall in academia. But certainly addressing the issue is one step further for the improvement.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing I would like to add to this is that if you start complaining about your salary in academia, the immediate answer you will get is that you have gained so many skills and you can find so many jobs in the industry that right now for someone with your qualifications, you'll be paid a way higher salary. So they tell me that I went to study a very specific topic of science, and because what I wanted to gain the skills that are transferable to then leave academia, like I stayed to do a PhD and a first postdoc and a second postdoc and to get the funding and then to get another funding and then to get another funding to at some point tell me that there are not permanent positions that you could be employed for. But look at all these positions in academia. Outside academia, sorry. So I could have left already a long time ago. If I've stayed so long, then it means I want to be here. This is what I want to be doing. And of course, competition exists in the industry too, no doubt. The problem is not just the existence of competition. The problem is that the rate with which doctoral candidates are graduating has increased a lot in the recent years, but the amount of positions that become available for researchers have not. And for me, it's a joke to be told that at the moment we are among the highest educated people in a country and we get a lower salary than someone who left the university after a bachelor's or a master's.
Yes, and lack of tenure track positions, which is basically a permanent a position in academia is
a way to permanency.
A way to permanency. It's one of the reasons why people really become desperate because they see that this is how I've been progressing, but constantly applying for grant, which is for a short time period, and then realizing that in 2 or 3 years you have to apply again. It's very emotionally tiresome. And realizing that there is no way for you to get some sort of security and just calm down and do the work you wanted to do, it's really very demotivating. And that's one more reasons why people decide to leave. So maybe they would get still a less permanent position, non-permanent position, less guaranteed. In industry, they also kick people out at a whim, just like with the flick of fingers. But at the same time, over the period that they've been working there, they can get, again, a better salary, better savings, and overall, they aren't that emotionally drained, and they have maybe more energy to go do something else. But yeah, that's one thing. And just overall, the professional growth is very much motivated in academia. You're always encouraged to just come on, move forward, move forward, move forward. But you just sometimes you're happy the way you are, where you are. And being a PI or a head of a group is not really for everyone. And there's nothing wrong in just doing your science.
Yeah, you're very right in saying that, like, there is really no possibility to just be a scientist. And one thing I often say to colleagues of mine is like, I just want to be left at my desk at a corner and do research. I study the sun and the interplanetary space, and I just want to analyze data, try to work with models, develop tools to do that. But at the same time, you are encouraged to keep on accumulating funding. And there are these, like at every level in academia, from when you're a doctoral candidate to even when you become a permanent professor, there is a constant pressure to achieve something and to keep on, as you said, aiming for personal growth, but with very little guarantee that anything more permanent will come out of it. Like, you know, if I sit and spend 1 month to apply for this funding, which is never 1 month because you need to develop the idea, you need to do background research to make sure that you have not been forgetting what's the state of the art, like you are not a bit left behind, let's say, and to make sure that what you're proposing is doable. And then you have maybe a month or two to do some research and then publish it because you need publications to be even more eligible to get funding. You need to do supervision to be more eligible to get funding. You need to do more teaching, as I found out recently, apparently, for some people, it's a criteria, because when you have all these good scientists who produce enough but high quality research, then how do you differentiate among them and to whom you give the funding? You look into all these little details, and all these little details makes you, again, work extra hours, as we were saying earlier. So you are automatically expected to strive to go up, but do you really go up? Is there personal growth in academia? And for how many will that become a reality?
Yeah, that was so well said. But also so many things that you pointed out right now, maybe we could just break them down a little bit, because I can rant on many of these smaller things for hours as well. Well, first of all, probably the closest one to me right now, as I'm working on my own manuscript as well, is publishing fees. And just overall, the publishing culture in academia, it's... To me, like many people, they expect that when we publish a paper, we get paid. And I don't know how many people outside academia know that actually scientists are the ones paying the journals to have their work published. And to me, it was also funny because sometimes they have these competitions for the cover page for a journal, and they say, submit us your best pictures and you'll be sort of honored to be selected. And then I thought, oh, that's so cool, I would like to submit mine as well. But then I found out that it's about 1,000 euros to have your picture published there on the front page. That seems like it does not match in my mind.
Yeah, right. That's also like something very hard for me as well to digest. But just to give an idea to you, our audience, about publication in academia, because you might not be aware of it. Essentially, you do the research and you want to get the work out to the community, and you have two outlets. You go to conferences or workshops, or you publish the work. Best to publish the work before you go to a conference and workshop, because we do not live in an ideal world. There's a lot of ideas theft that can take place during a conference. So better be protective over your research.
And publish fast.
And publish fast. That's another topic. We can actually dive into it a lot. But what I wanted to clarify is that, so when we do the research and we want to publish it, we have to pay what is called a publication fee. But that doesn't mean that because we pay the moment we give our manuscript to the journal, that will automatically be published because we pay for it. No, it has to go through a process called peer review. And during peer review, you have one or two people who are experts in your field, and they will read your paper and they will evaluate it. And some of them might not like your results because they contradict theirs. So you have maybe multiple rounds of back and forth with the reviewers. Usually they are anonymous. They know who the authors are, but you don't know who the reviewers are for most journals. And so what happens is that there is this long process that for some people may last a year. And then you get finally your manuscript accepted. You're happy. Your research is going out in the world. In the meantime, you've done so many other things. Let's not forget that. But yeah, your research goes out in the world. You get, though, at the same time, a bill, which can be anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 euros, especially if you want to publish fully open access, which is the way we should be heading to now in the future. So where do we find that money? And on top of that, reviewers are not paid for assessing your manuscript. They might spend hours on your paper, on writing a report about it, multiple rounds, and no cash goes to their direction.
I would love to have a talk with an editor to see their side, because of course we're here just complaining as scientists. I would say fairly so, because this is a lot of money. But I would like to see more of an internal stuff that's going on in the journal itself. But it is a lot of money for, like, it's more than our monthly salary. It tells you something about it.
Yeah, and like, that's a good point. I would also like to ask an editor. Of course, usually the editors are from our field. They are fellow colleagues who have been selected. I'm not sure if they get something for their job. I hope they do. But there's also the publishing companies or groups, and they have boards, and I understand there's the printing services, there's the finance people, there's the language editors, there's all these people who need to be paid somehow. But I agree with you, it's more than our monthly salary, and we are expected to cover that expense because the university has an agreement only with a handful of journals at the same time. So if you want to publish in a different journal that the university doesn't have an agreement with, what do you do?
I would say that competition keeps on going in the publications as well. Well, as we just said, like, the you need to publish fast, then the editors themselves can be your own competitors who would try to press down what you've been trying to publish, like some of your ideas sometimes, especially if they're controversial and breaking some established dogmas. And this just reminded me randomly of a breakfast at one of the conferences that I had. And I just struck a conversation with a person who works in an industry, and he moved from academia into an industry. And then I said, well, how does it feel to work there? I feel like when it's business and it's really involved with money, it must be very competitive. It must be a lot of pressure from your bosses and from overall environment to produce results faster. But he said that actually the opposite. He feels like academia is much worse in that regard than industry. And industry is really like a shark tank of people constantly competing and biting each other's tails. And this is something I would say is really nurtured, because maybe this is how you get all that progress. This is how you grow. I don't know, evolution, survival of the fittest, call it whatever. And at the same time, it's sort of sad, because in my experience, the best results I achieve is from a teamwork, from when I work equally with people and everybody feels that they're significant in the team and in the stuff that we are producing. But still a lot of stuff, and especially this individualistic perception of work, is being enhanced in academia, and I don't know how to really improve this any further.
I totally agree with you. Like, as an animal species, throughout the history of, I don't want to use the word mankind because it contains the word man, and I'm trying to use gender neutral words.
Humankind, mankind, No, man, humankind.
Human has also the word man. Yeah, it's like throughout all the civilizations that ever existed, we know that people group together in communities because they discovered that by grouping together, they had higher chances of surviving. And we all naively think that, yeah, that's, you know, academia is a very friendly environment, et cetera, and it's only in companies that they will all try to step onto each other. But it's not true. Like, I always see my colleagues as my friends, but in the end, we compete. For example, we apply to the same funding calls.
It all comes back to money, I'm sorry.
Yes, it all comes back to money. Even if we don't want to compete, the system puts us in that position. Because in Finland, there is the Academy of Finland call, and you have, I don't know how many hundreds of people, I don't remember, applying for a pool of money. And in space physics, almost everyone, not everyone, but almost everyone in my corridor and from other universities around Finland, we applied to the same funding call. And out of all these people, one or two will get the funding. So yes, of course there's competition because you want to be that one or two, because in the end it's a survival game. You want to survive in academia, you need to attract funding. Then to attract funding, you need publications, as you said. There is competition. I can't begin to tell you how many times I have noticed people showing preliminary results at conferences and other people jumping who might have had the resources to do that work faster and then publish it first. And it becomes like whoever is the fastest wins, you know, and that becomes like whoever is the fastest wins or whoever publishes the best result wins. It is maybe more subtle than this industry concept you described, but it's still competition and there is individualism.
I had maybe a slightly different example just from a lab that's next to us, because they contacted another lab who were studying, I think, the same disease, but the number of patients was very small. And they proposed to them, why don't we merge our manuscripts and merge the same patients, like the maybe five of them that were existing, and just publish a paper together, basically. But at least we will have more examples and it will strengthen our work in the end. But they apparently wanted more credit to themselves and they wanted to publish it first. Unfortunately for them, they did not. And this other lab published it faster. But it was just like this wrong spirit. I understand where they were coming from. They wanted to be the first ones to report maybe such a disease. I was not involved in the progress, so I was only hearing this from the person telling the story. But that's the unfortunate reality we live here in academia.
That's a very sad story, and I can think of similar examples in my field. When it comes to me, I really don't mind if people do the same research I do. I don't mind if we get the same results, because we are scientists, not for our career building. We are scientists for science. And what should matter, as you said, is to strengthen the research result that you put out there. So the more people come to the same conclusion, that should be perfectly fine. But going back again to funding, I'm sorry, Anastasia, I have to do this one more time. And tying to the publications, that if you are doing the same things as others and they have published before you, then your idea and your results are not novel anymore. And so you have less chances of getting funding. And sometimes the editors of journals might think that, you know, this has already been published. What value does it bring to the journal? We want to increase our impact factor. So to do that, we need to publish manuscripts, research work, etc., etc. That is state of the art and will get many citations. And yours is something that has already been out there, so you don't bring anything new to our journal. So yes, you might hear that from some editors.
And don't get me started on a very old publication that very rarely people go back to, but then they re-explore something and they claim that this was the first time reported, but actually no. And I think maybe in physics more than in biology, you can probably tell more examples. But I hear this from my boyfriend who is in physics, and he tells me, like, people just like to repeat the stuff they were too lazy to read. And the papers were, like, from 60s or 70s, or maybe even before that sometimes.
That's a very nice topic you brought forth, because I also have seen in the field different categories of scientists who publish their research. There's the people who publish a lot of papers, but because they developed a technique that can be applied to some observations, etc., etc., they tend to just, you know, something happens, you get the observations for it, you analyze the data, you publish it, and it's always the same process, the same method, more or less leading to the same outcome, but they end up publishing a lot. And there are these fine words that you can use to make it look as a more novel thing. Then there are the people, as you said, that something was published a long time ago and they just don't know very well their bibliography because, well, sometimes you don't have enough time to read all those papers. So there's also that category. And I'm not sure what's the best way to overcome, especially this second category that we discussed.
Well, I would say just before you publish, just do literature search. Like for a specific, for example, finding that you have, like just Google like this event or this finding. And usually just from the keywords, you can sort of find it. But to me personally, the problem I found with the old publication is that they're harder to find. It's hard to find this original text, and can I say that I had to resort to Sci-Hub? I don't want to enforce it, but I had no other way. There was no other way.
It's not wrong to say that.
Because university did not pay for it. And I found like that paper was very relevant for me, and maybe the techniques weren't very powerful and the paper wasn't very big, but at least it delivered what it was supposed to deliver, and it measured this one thing, but it measured it well.
I love it so much that you brought that up, because that's true, and I have had that problem as well. So the university pays the fee for some journals, because this is for you, our viewers, not only the authors we pay to get our work published, but also if we don't have the finances to publish it fully open access, you as the reader will have to pay a fee to read the work. And so what happens is that the universities have some agreements with journals, and then we can access the papers, no fee, nothing, perfectly fine. But quite often for my research, I need to look into papers from some journals that the university also doesn't pay the fee. And you go to Sci-Hub, I go to my colleagues at other countries and other institutes and universities and say, do you have access to this?
Yeah. Now imagine being in a poorer university where maybe they don't even pay for most of the journals we get access to. And what if they don't have people to contact? That they have no other choice but to go to these illegal websites and read there. That's a sad reality again.
Yes. I hope we won't get a fee now for saying that.
Yes, we don't endorse this.
We don't endorse it. Absolutely not. Do not follow that example.
Yes, please try to search. Maybe if this is a journal that you really need, and you use more often, would it help to just contact the library and ask them to pay for the membership?
Maybe you just can and we don't know it, right?
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll come back to you in the next episode after we try to ask them for access to a different journal or for a different article.
Okay, we touched a lot on the other topics, such as getting funding, publication, etc., etc. But one thing we can return to is something we kind of hinted to, and but didn't dive into more detail, and that's the declining value of high education. So what does that mean? You can put it in simple words. How would you phrase it, Anastasia?
Yeah, I would say it's declining first and foremost because there are many people who want to continue with PhD. I'm one of the examples, and if you listen to the previous episode on PhD that we did, I basically approached PhD out of having nothing else to do or knowing what else to do. I wasn't like super excited about this, but I still love science, don't get me wrong. And I think most of the people approach it with the same way. They sort of like academia, they're not sure if they're ready to transition into industry or something else. And so they decide, okay, I'll just continue with a PhD. But another thing, of course, is that PhD is also more demanded these days, but for sometimes much smaller positions. It's because there's so many PhDs coming out that they really desperately need to go somewhere else that you can, again, recruit them for smaller positions that don't necessarily require that much experience that you get in your PhD.
So you see that as the source of declining, and to some extent it is, but it's totally understandable that after you finish your bachelor's, maybe you did a master's, and you want to explore a little bit more. You want to test the waters to see what's further there or out there that you can do. And although that wasn't my story, it's totally understandable that somebody didn't want to do a PhD because they really wanted to pursue an academic life, but because they wanted to explore a little bit more before deciding what they want to do. And then they ended up loving academia. That's perfectly fine. The problem, though, starts that universities get funding from the governments, or at least in the countries I'm familiar with, based on how many people they graduate. The more you graduate, the more funding you get as a university because you did an excellent job. But then how much care is placed on what happens to the people you graduate? Because even if you leave academia, then suddenly you have a large outflow of people with PhDs leaving academia. And they will find a job in a company. And the company said, well, I have so many choices. Why would I give them a good salary? Because I can hire any of them with less. And if they're not happy, I can fire them and hire someone else. So what does it really do to our future? Is it really that necessary that so many people graduate with a PhD? Or if they do, what does the institution do to ensure that they are having a future ahead of them, which is based on the value of the diploma they get?
This is truly food for thoughts.
I always make topics depressing. I'm terribly sorry.
It's not depressing, but it is deep. And it's something to think about afterwards, I would say. Very often when I'm asked, like, so do you love science? I like to tell people, well, let's break this down. Science and academia are very different things. I love science, but I don't like academia.
I think that reflects how many people feel, to be honest.
Yes, maybe more people would have stayed in academia or in science, if not all these disadvantages that we just mentioned that are perpetually staying in academia and some are getting worse. Of course, they're influenced by the crisis of the time. It's all a chain and it's all a network and many things are interdependent. But
that resonates with me as well, because what I was saying before, that my story was slightly different to yours, is that I didn't do the PhD because I wanted to explore, like, what's that and what's more is out there. I always wanted to be a scientist, And I was always very drawn to science, whether it was, biology, physics, later on astrophysics, paleontology, seismology, earthquakes.
You're a curious person.
You can be curious about many things. I was curious about nature, science, and exploring and trying to understand, like, why is this like this? Why is that like that? So I always knew that science is my calling. It's how I felt very comfortable. Science and theater, but that's a topic for another time. But anyway, so when I was at high school, I said, okay, I want to be a scientist for the rest of my life. So what do I have to do to become one? And I saw, I'll do my bachelor's, I'll do my master's, and then I have to do a PhD, and then I'll get a postdoc, and then I'll get a permanent tenure track position to become a professor. That was like the journey you had to take. Of course, there's upside downs and there's back and forth throughout that. But for me, PhD was my only way to go and become what I wanted to become. But more and more, I notice that when I, have to do some research, and that is what will pay my salary, versus when I do a research which I know it doesn't pay my salary, it's not included in what I'm doing, but it's interesting, I do the second with more pleasure. Why? Because the research that is tied with my salary has become something that actually makes me feel very, very exhausted and depressed quite a lot.
No, Eliana, no. Next episode is going to be fixing Eliana's mental state.
Mental health. Yeah. No, let's not do an episode about that. It will be an hours long episode.
People will be calling online. We'll be giving them advice as well. It will be just...
An emotional
support episode. I'm just kidding. Yeah. Maybe one day.
No, maybe one day. But what I'm trying to say is that if I know that I'm doing this science because I have the free choice to do it, it's not what will put food on my table and pay my rent, then I am so happy doing it. And that, for me, exactly describes what you said, that liking science and liking academia are two totally different things.
I think with that, it's a perfect time to wrap up this episode, because we can go on about this much more, and we will in a second part of this one. Not sure when it's going to be released, but please come back for more of our Rumble. And also check check out our social media. I mean, I know it sounds very random right now, but yes, we are on Twitter and Instagram. Please do see and like what you see, hopefully.
Oh, and what you hear.
Yes. Please leave us your feedback, comments, share your own experience. Maybe there would be some things that you personally hate about academia that we could also add in the part two. So please let us know, and we'll be happy to hear back from you. But otherwise, see you in the next one. Bye.
Bye.